So nonviolence is one of those big words that can encompass a lot of different practices, tools, and types of actions. But if we start just with nonviolent action, that's a toolbox that includes things like protests, which many of us know, boycotts and strikes, occupations, blockades, shutdowns, walkouts, call-in-sicks, demonstrations, rallies, marches, banners, posters, music, singing, the list goes on and on. There's actually over 300 different methods of nonviolent action. And, the hallmark of them is that they're not causing harm to people, and most of the time, not harm to property either. So it's a useful toolbox, but actually the word nonviolence goes on, and it can also describe practices and policies that are rooted in approaches that don't cause harm to other people. And one of the ways I like to explain this is by actually talking about violence. Many of us know what physical violence is, how that feels, what that looks like. But more and more of us are starting to pick up on the fact that there's other kinds of violences. There's systemic or structural violence, like the violence of slavery, or the violence of discriminatory policies, or the violence of the war machine, for example. So if you have systemic or structural violences, it stands to reason that you could also have systemic or structural nonviolence. And these are alternatives. So instead of having a punitive justice system where people get sent to prison for long prison sentences, we can have restorative justice. And this has been actually really helpful for intervening in things like the school-to-prison pipeline or disproportionate minority impacts in the justice system. And we're seeing many communities across the US and beyond start to implement restorative justice practices, particularly in schools, but increasingly with juvenile justice programs and even with certain types of adult offenses. So that's just one of the many examples of nonviolent systems and structures that can be implemented that can replace those kinds of systemic and structural violences that have become all too familiar and all too norm in our society.
Right. And how did you start writing and thinking about nonviolence and social change in the first place?
I grew up with a father who was an anti-Vietnam War activist, but I didn't actually become an activist till I was much older in life when the Occupy movement happened right across the street from where I lived. It was hard to ignore that our local encampment in California, where I was loud and very visible, and I had to come out of my house and say, "What's going on?" So that got me started in activism, and several years later, I was writing my novel, The Dandelion Insurrection, and I realized I had gotten my characters in a mess that I didn't know how to get them out of. So I actually Googled how to bring down dictators nonviolently and got 4 million hits back and started reading and realized that there's an entire field, science, art, movement, everything you can think of around nonviolent action. And it's the kind of tools that any of us can pick up anywhere, anyone.
Definitely. And you mentioned the Occupy movement just now, and I'm wondering if there are any lessons that you learned from Occupy that you've been able to apply to other movements for nonviolence.
Sure. I think movements are always learning and growing. They're wildly experimental in their nature, and Occupy was certainly a great example of that. I think one of the things, not just Occupy, but actually the global field of nonviolent action is learning and remembering is that we can't just rely on mass demonstrations and mass protests. That actually, if we want our movements to be successful, we need to pair those types of visible, large demonstrations with acts of non-cooperation, things like boycotts and shutdowns and walkouts, or acts of nonviolent intervention like blockades and shutdowns and strikes, civil disobedience. And the reason we need to do this is because we need to disrupt the churning of the injustice as usual. We need to get in the way of that injustice. And if we don't disrupt the daily operations of how our society is participant in the wrongdoing, then it's easy for those power holders to simply just, you know, shut themselves up in their ivory towers and ignore the social movement. So by pairing tactics, we not only become more effective and impactful, but we also start to diversify our approaches. So if, for example, as happens around the world, police actually, or the government shuts down the right to assemble, the right to have demonstrations or to protest, then our movement isn't left hung out to dry. We already can call upon our people to move into a boycott campaign, for example, or a general strike or an industry-wide strike. It gives us a versatility. It gives us a resilience in our movement. I think that's one of the most important lessons for activists right now, especially since in the United States, we have historically been used to having the right to protest, and that has been increasingly rolled back. Of course, people of color and low-income groups, people who have less privilege in the society, have been warning U.S. activists at large about this for years. And we're really seeing that. We certainly saw it with the George Floyd protests, and we're seeing it with the climate protests. We've seen it around indigenous-led anti-pipeline protests, that the power holders are trying to restrict those rights. They're trying to pass 81 bills across the country restricting our right to protest. In my opinion, that is a violation of our First Amendment rights, but we're going to have to duke it out in court, apparently. But we need to, as activists, be aware that for many reasons, simply standing up and shouting may not be effective, and it may be increasingly risky. And so we need to open up that toolbox and pull out other tools so that we can be prepared for the times that we're in.
We're speaking with Rivera Sun, who leads workshops on nonviolent strategy. And Rivera, I'm wondering if you could share some of the strategies that you teach in your workshops.
Yeah, I have done trainings across the country and internationally as well. And what I specifically focus on a lot is strategy for nonviolent movements. And so we'll be looking at some of the things that we've been talking about today, but also what are design elements for a successful campaign, learning from the past and applying to the present. Who's going to be the participants in our movement? What types of action are they going to do? How long is our campaign going to last? What do we do when we need to shift tactics? How is our communications going to be handled? What is our message, our demand, our slogans? How do we mitigate some of the risks that our movement might be facing? How do we build participation in our movement with groups of people who may be odd bedfellows that we might not be used to working with? So these are all aspects to being strategic about the work that we're doing. And successful movements throughout history have used this approach. They've been skillful. They've been wise. They've been thoughtful about what they're doing. They have directly impacted the situation with direct action, with acts of non-cooperation and intervention. And one of my goals in these movements is to make sure that everyone in our populace has these tools. I am a firm believer that strategy is wiser when we do it together. It shouldn't be the purview of just a handful of really smart people. That when our whole movement knows how to plan, it starts to behave strategically. This is a quote from one of the Otpor activists in Serbia who overthrew the dictator Milosevic in 2000. So when everyone knows how to plan, you start to see strategic behavior. And personally, I would love to see that in a broad sector of the U.S. populace, particularly with our social justice movements, because I think we're up against so many challenges that we can't rely on one or two movements to do all the strategizing for all that needs to be done. We need people to know how to use these tools. They come from a very long lineage around the world. We sometimes get into a bad habit of thinking of nonviolence as something that only certain types of peace activists use. But actually, nonviolence is as old as the hills. The first recorded strike happened in 1170 BC in Egypt, when tomb workers who were building a tomb for the pharaoh went on strike because the pharaoh hadn't paid them. And we see that people of almost every country around the world, of every race, ethnicity, nationality, every age, every gender, every sexual orientation, every political persuasion for that matter, have picked up these tools and used them for their goals. So I really like to remind us that we borrow these tools from generations of humanity. We learn them from people who have resisted and struggled against the oppressions and injustices that they faced. And when we ignore them, it's a shame. It's a crying shame that we can't see that thousands of years of history have delivered these tools to us at this moment of need that is very great in our society.
Yes. And, you know, it's interesting because I perused your newsletter for a while from Nonviolence News. And rather than get that kind of hopeless feeling that I often get listening to the news on the radio or watching TV, your roundups filled me with a sense of hope. And I'm wondering if that in itself is a strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. So Nonviolence News is a news service that I run that collects 30 to 50 stories of nonviolence in action each week. And people can always run through or scroll through the weekly roundups at nonviolencenews.org. But we do try to look for all these different kinds of nonviolence that we've been describing so far in the show, but then also, as you mentioned, ways of practicing nonviolence towards ourself. So rather than just making social change with nonviolence or having structural or systemic nonviolence or interpersonal nonviolence, like nonviolent communication, we also are looking for ways that we respect ourselves, that we find ways to rest when we need rest, to eat healthy food, to meditate, to take a break when we need to stop that cycle in our own minds where we're constantly demeaning ourselves or putting ourselves down. The list of this goes on. You know, there's many ways that we practice violence towards ourselves, some, you know, fairly small and others very large, including cutting or some abuses or addictions can also be forms of violence towards ourselves. So there's a lot of practices that people have developed for shifting those patterns. And they often go by other names. You know, you may be finding mindfulness as a stress reduction tactic. You may be finding a community that's trying to cook healthier together. So nonviolence often masquerades. It often very graciously goes by another name, by another way of describing it. But if you start to look deeply, you can start to see that it is all around us and increasingly so in our societies.
Yeah, and the other cool thing about nonviolence news is that you have so many great international examples of nonviolence.
Absolutely. One of the reasons I cover so many international stories in nonviolence news is because in the U.S., we tend to get stuck in our own media bubble. We tend to pay attention, when we do pay attention, to our own issues and our own problems and our own stories and our own solutions. But when we look beyond our borders, and we listen and we learn from people who are rising up against injustice, we are forced to reconsider some of our very basic assumptions, because people are thinking about these issues in very different ways. Iceland, for example, just test run, a 4-day work week, right? Which is almost unfathomable in U.S. society, where so many of us are overworked and underpaid. Or in France, this is a great pandemic story, actually, they had an abandoned McDonald's in a certain neighborhood, and they actually broke into the McDonald's. They, you know, they used bolt cutters and opened up the doors, and they converted it into a fast, quote unquote, food bank, where they would collect the foods and they would actually distribute it right out that little sliding window that you usually get your hamburger and your fries out of. And one of the things that happened with this is that the government of France actually ended up buying the McDonald's and giving it back to the community to stop the police from evicting the food bank, because they had done such amazing work of taking care of people all throughout the crisis.
I love that story, and it makes me think about how over the past year during the pandemic, communities have really leaned into the idea of mutual aid. And I'm wondering what you can tell us about the history of mutual aid in nonviolent movements.
Yeah, mutual aid is a great example of learning from the past. As your listeners may know, mutual aid comes to us from the labor movement. And it basically is people helping people, but taking out the framework of have and have not, which is typically embedded in charitable giving or charity work, but rather to see one another as equal human beings and to help one another from a sense of solidarity. In the labor movement, mutual aid was dramatic and large and involved, you know, huge amounts of food and fundraising to support striking workers all across the country, and indeed across countries around the world. We also saw it in things like when the Lowell textile workers went on strike. These mothers mostly sent their children to live with strangers in the mutual aid network in Vermont so they would be safe, they would be fed, they would be warm and sheltered, even if the strike breakers managed to get the mothers evicted from the houses that they lived in, for example, or, you know, they didn't have the money to feed the children. That kind of solidarity is breathtaking and awe-inspiring, and we have seen a resurgence of that spirit in the responses to COVID. Mutual aid networks sprung up across the country. There's more than 400 of them now. So that is one of the things you see over and over again, is that people are incredibly creative. And when we know the stories of our past, it actually fuels our creativity in the present. We can borrow tools from those who came before, but we can also invent new tools for our times.
We're speaking to nonviolent activist Rivera Sun. And Rivera, I first encountered your work in an article you wrote about the Nonviolent Cities Project. And I wonder if you could share a little bit about that organization.
Yes, Pache Ibene, which is a 30-year-old nonviolence organization, started a program called the Nonviolent Cities Project. And the bold idea with this was to look around at our city or our community or town and say, where are these forms of structural and systemic violence? How does violence happen in our community? And how is one form of violence often responded to with another form of violence? And what can we as citizens do to start to shift that equation and break that cycle? So the Nonviolent Cities Project is being organized in over 50 cities across the U.S. It was launched in Carbondale, Illinois, which was actually the model nonviolent city. And we learned about the idea from them. They had their local library host a series of gatherings for different civic groups and individuals in which they put forward this vision that we could root our practices as a community in nonviolent alternatives. You know, many of these groups are small groups of really amazing, heartful individuals doing what they can, where they can, as they can. But they're all carrying the kind of broad vision of what this might look like. And honestly, they're learning a lot from a lot of our social justice movements. And we often don't think of something like the call to defund police and fund street teams that are unarmed and still disrupt and interrupt and de-escalate violence as a nonviolent call to action, but it is. And so in the nonviolent cities, they're picking up on ideas such as that and helping to bring them to their city or to support the campaigns that are pre-existing. They're looking at different forms of community safety rooted in nonviolence. So when there's a protest, can a peace team be there instead of the police, as was just done in Minneapolis during a local street festival? Can we create a accompaniment service for vulnerable community members when they don't feel safe riding the subway, that they can just call someone and have someone ride along with them? A nonviolent city would also teach nonviolence specifically and directly and overtly to its citizenry. So that might look like the Nonviolent Schools Project, which was started in Rhode Island at a public elementary school, teaching practices of nonviolence as a form of alternative conflict navigation. This school actually front loads a week of nonviolence training and conflict resolution with the entire school. And when teachers ask, but what about your standard curriculum? What if you lose time? They say, we make up that time later on because we don't have to spend so much time on discipline in our classroom. And it is inspiring to see the stories framed in this way. We're not just reading reports of how bad everything is getting. We're also reading at the same time about the people who are doing something about it and the solutions that they're proposing. And there is something very empowering about that, very grounding, very centering. And there's a lot in there that we can learn from. We're still paying attention. We're not putting our heads in the sand, but we're paying attention to the news in such a way that we learn from and with our other fellow human beings who are standing up for profound change and proposing some of the best and brightest ideas on the planet.